So I hope you've all taken the chance to read the slide behind me. That's so that I could clip my 15 minutes, right? I wouldn't have to read that. This is from a pamphlet issued by the Textile Workers Union of America in 1943 to its members. It was part of a booklet that was distributed to all its members. And it was kind of an extraordinary contemporary notice of changes in the World War II economy that are even less remembered today. The federal government financed over two-thirds of wartime capital expansion. And there you go, you see the GNP is the bars and the line is private investment, right? So you see that massive growth in GNP during the war, all funded by government investment, virtually. In 1945, as a result, the government owned 40% of the country's capital assets. When capital had refused to increase investment after 1939, the government built war production industries such as aircraft, shipbuilding, and ordnance, but also steel and aluminum mills, electric generation, oil and gas pipelines. It invented synthetic rubber manufacture. Some facilities, like here we are, the gigantic Willow Run bomber facility. This was a mile long, and it was a mile in each direction, this plant. Some facilities were leased to manufacturers, so built by the government and then leased, and Ford produced goods on a cost plus basis. In other industries and other facilities, government hired a management team, and government owned machine tools, blast furnaces, and other equipment, modernized existing plant in an economy that had seen little private investment since the 1920s. Much of the commanding heights of the American economy, to use Lenin's phrase, were in the hands of the state. At least two-thirds of this publicly owned industry was estimated as easily convertible to production of peacetime products, a fearful prospect to existing monopoly capital. Senator Robert Taft feared government would compete with private business. The Investment Bankers Association warned of, quote, a shortcut to national socialism. What will happen to these government plants when the emergency ends? There will be people who will insist the government make use of them. Accordingly, in March 1944, capital swiftly mobilized behind the basic principles of financier Bernard Baruch's report to the Office of War Mobilization about what should happen to all this government-owned property. And you can see he says, take the government out of business, sell fast, and no government operation of surplus war plants in competition with private industry. Now, there was no lack of alternatives to Baruch and the Baruch plan. Some left new dealers suggested in 1943 that where government investment dominated, such as aluminum, magnesium, synthetic rubber, and aircraft, joint private government partnerships should be developed. And this had occurred in aluminum during the war, that the government and Alcoa actually split the profits of sales of aluminum. That fall, others argued for continued government ownership in monopolistic economic centers to ensure full production, prevent unemployment, and provide yardstick pricing. That is, the government would set a fair price for its goods and keep monopolies from charging a higher price. Answering Baruch, Harold Ickes advocated consolidating all government-owned plants and equipment into one giant corporation with all shares distributed to returning veterans. This, he asserted, was a revised edition of the Homestead Acts. Only these shareholders would really be interested in maximum production and employment. As post-war policies for these vast investments were being worked out, the left and the unions whose members worked in these plants were, for the most part, missing in action. Although we might expect communist organizations to support continued government ownership, even as they sought to remove its capitalist management component, they seemed almost oblivious. Perhaps this issue fell between their immediate concerns of workplace agitation on the one hand and the longer run ones of socialism. That disinterest made it even easier for labor to largely support the Burke plan and embrace privatization. A significant first marker of post-war class reconciliation well before the miscarried 1946 UAW strike, compliance with Taft-Hartley, and the Treaty of Detroit. So, talk about the left first. Even today, the Communist Party's calls for unity with capital remain startling and heartbreaking. In October 1941, it asserted that a planned war economy does not... Hey, are you Eric?
I am.
Hey,
hey.
How are you doing us?
Yeah.
Should I sit down?
Yeah,
did you do a presentation?
He's in the middle of the first one.
Don't worry,
you're fine.
Thank you.
In October 1941, it asserted that a planned war economy does not call for any fundamental changes in the existing capitalist system or the capitalist mode of production. The CP's journals touted what Earl Browder later called the Tehran program. The Democratic Progressive Camp, he wrote, quote, could not win the country if it sponsored even a mild program of government ownership of the banks, railroads, mines, public utilities, and so on, although such measures would greatly improve the efficiency of capitalism. Briefly, after the Baruch Report and Icke's response, the CP addressed disposition of government-owned property. It liked how Icke's idea, quote, far from being a move in the direction of government ownership, could broaden the base of private enterprise. But in the end, it backed Baruch. A TVA plan, it said, might be preferable, but such a choice would cause, quote, sharp class conflict and undermine national unity. A year of silence followed. Browder was expelled. In July 1945, a report on the West Coast economy urged the government to find buyers willing to operate plants that were closing. Otherwise, it warned the people of the West will certainly demand the operation of their new plants by the government. The same day Japan surrendered, it announced that state ownership was the most effective weapon for hampering and curbing the monopolies too late. The Workers' Party made its name in 1943 to 45 by its support for striking workers. Its long-range program was a socialist workers' state. But the actual government ownership of vast swaths of the American economy was ignored until 1943, when it finally noticed that, quote, construction of new plants essential to the prosecution of the conflict was accomplished by the state. Yet the question this raised, who will own the government-built plants and facilities at war's end, was framed only as a squabble between different sectors of capital, between the big monopolists, non-monopoly wealthy capitalists, and the middle layer of manufacturers over slices of the pie. The thought these plants should remain in government hands as a pathway towards socialism does not seem to have occurred. And in response to the Baruch plan, they only advocated, quote, developing an independent labor reconversion program seeking to aid the workers. The Socialist Workers' Party did a bit better. In March 1941, it pointed to a deal between big corporations and a bountiful government in which productive facilities are paid for by the people and then operated for the benefit of corporate interests. But then the SWP fumbled its response. It called for, quote, the expropriation of the war industries and their nationalization, and grumbled that a government can plan only that which it owns and controls, apparently forgetting how much the government did in fact own. After July 1943, reportage on ownership and reconversion ended until October 1945. Much like the Workers' Party, the SWP seemed confused on how to assess and respond to burgeoning social ownership within a capitalist economy. And of course, each might have argued that government ownership was a fraud, a dead end, but if so, why simultaneously call for expropriation? When we look at labor's responses, we find a brief spasm of discussion beginning in mid-1943, simultaneous with that first slide I showed you, largely disappearing by early 1944. As reconversion neared and then began, and as plants began to close, labor was silent about a program for these facilities, despite some indications of ferment among members. So the AFL, in fall 1943, the AFL's post-war planning committee pondered, quote, how government should use or dispose of public-owned plants and facilities. It took it 2 years to answer that question. In September 1945, it finally answered, perhaps some of them might be kept, quote, as experimental and pilot plants for national defense purposes, but the vast bulk of the publicly built and owned industrial capacity should be transferred to private enterprise for productive peacetime use. In the CIO, the TWA's June 43 demand quoted earlier, or shown earlier, also called for control of industry for the many, not the few, nationalization of public utilities and all natural resources, and control over monopolistic industries, quote, to assure the full use of our human, technical, and mechanical resources for the common good. But by the next spring, it was more equivocal. After criticizing Baruch Plan privatization, reportage disappeared from its newspaper. In May, its president mused at a conference on the post-war, perhaps a government corporation like the TVA or following Icke's idea deserves greater consideration, the ultimate disposal of this government investment so that it shall be of the greatest benefit to all Americans will not be an easy problem to solve, he declared. Then its newspaper, Textile Labor, fell mute, neither denunciation or alternative for the rest of the war. What about the auto and steelworkers unions, whose members were directly affected by reconversion? In July 1943, the UAW's post-war program had called vaguely for government to, quote, utilize the productive resources of the nation if private industry was unable to do so, and less ambiguously for, quote, government or municipal ownership and operation of monopolistic industries and of industries strategically essential to the national safety. In December, congressional testimony, it proposed all government facilities be managed by one tripartite commission that might lease to manufacturers who met conditions on union recognition, employment, wages, and low prices. Yet this testimony was not even reported in the UAW newspaper. Reconversion was completely ignored at its October 1943 convention and at a meeting of aircraft delegates the next February, also ignored, although this industry was understood to be at risk. In March, a UAW War Vets conference did hark back to 43's demand for public ownership in monopolistic or semi-monopolistic industries. But in April, response to the Baruch Plan noted the CIO's support for the basic aims of the report. Thereafter, the idea of public ownership for the public good disappeared even as aircraft plants closed. Response to the June 1945 shutdown of the 20,000 member Willow Run, earlier glorified as the pinnacle of American wartime achievement, was sadly typical. For months, the UAW just excoriated Ford for closing this plant. Far too late in August, after the plant was closed, after the workers were dispersed, Walter Reuther proposed reopening the plant, perhaps to produce prefab housing or railroad rolling stock, perhaps leased, or as a worker cooperative, or a TA. It's just blowing smoke. This vague and belated scheme just smacks of Reuther trying to buff his credentials to laid off workers as he prepared for his presidential run. Philip Merry wore hats at the CIO and the steelworkers. In May 1943, the CIO wanted government to help small businesses, quote, take over all or parts of war plants for peace production. In October, members were told they owned $20 billion worth of plant and equipment. Monopoly wanted to shutter or buy it cheap, but the punchline was to elect congressmen who would, quote, make sure our property is used for our benefit to produce the maximum of consumer goods and maintain maximum employment. In November, Merry noted that the government-owned facilities, quote, are a new form of the public domain as important as the Western lands which the nation owned a century ago. Yeah, It's worth pointing out, those lands, of course, were privatized. And that was the likely fate of this national property, too. Only, he demanded, for the benefit of the people, not the few. And that was it, except for one odd moment as government-owned steel mills shut down during 1945 and pressure grew on leadership from the affected locals. In June 1945, steel labor urged those locals to try, quote, to arouse community sentiment. No. Fire alarm.
Time's up.
Pretty much, yes.
There you go.
That will be an odd interlude on the tape. So they were urging locals to try to arouse community sentiment for the disposal of plants in a way to promote full employment. 3 months later, Murray testified to Congress that resolutions were being passed in locals asking for government operation. The average citizen asks, why does, this is him talk, quote, the average citizen asks, why doesn't the government hire managers to operate these factories the way it was done during the war? Murray assured legislatures he opposed this idea. Quote, the American labor movement has upheld private competitive capitalism. But to forestall, quote, the pressure that is coming from the people, Congress needed to pass the CAO's full employment legislation. Otherwise, he warned, quote, a great deal more than this program will be necessary a year from now. So we know the end of the story, sold, mothballed, scrapped, and greater concentration of capital in the American economy. And we know about those magic words, free enterprise. I think the left just missed the boat on this question. And what about labor? On the one hand, the prospect of production for the public good, a blow against monopoly, maybe even a path toward substantive worker participation and management, the demands that Murray and Ruther later fruitlessly made of U.S. Steel and General Motors. A tantalizing perspective, yet it must have seemed to them also wildly speculative. The arguments against public ownership surely appeared far more tangible, and someone can ask me about strikes against the government during the 30s and 40s. Union leaders, and perhaps their members as well, were essentially volunteerists and incremental pragmatists at heart. They felt most comfortable negotiating with private employers about wages and benefits, less so discussing control of the workplace, and least of all attempting to collaborate with or fend off the state. Quote, if we let Uncle Sam do it, said the AFL's Robert Watt, speaking of nationalization, quote, he will not be our uncle much longer or even our cousin. He will then be known as Comrade Sammy or Fuhrer Sam. Murray and Ruther looked for government to advance working class interests, but their public works social insurance agenda must have seemed the clearest path, the macro version of accepting capitalist control over the workplace to secure better wages and benefits. As union leaders, they were willing to take half a loaf or a quarter, the bird in the hand over two in the bush. Their primary concern in reconversion was that most basic historic demand of American trade unionism, full employment at a decent wage. Their failure to educate their members about a different kind of post-war America was an unfortunate precursor to the decisions which culminated with the Treaty of Detroit's prioritizing of the paycheck. There was nothing inherently contradictory about full employment, good pay, and public ownership, but it would have required the kind of gamble on the future that labor then and now is dispositionally unwilling to take.
Okay, so hi, my name's Andy. I'm going to be talking about deindustrialization. And I'm gonna be talking about it through the lens of what are called runaway plants, which are plants that close up in one location and reopen in another. And by doing so, they trade in one set of technical conditions, one set of labor conditions for another one that they feel will be more cost effective. to them. And the specific example I'm going to use is one that's here in New York City. And so this is the American Safety Razor factory that's located, was located on J Street in downtown Brooklyn. If you may recognize the building. In fact, it is still there. It is part of NYU's engineering school today in a shift that it probably says something about the trajectory of New York. So, but at one time, during the first half of the 20th century, American Safety Razor was the number two razor blade manufacturer in the world. It was a mainstay of Brooklyn's industrial economy, and it was also the subject of one of the biggest runaway plant fights in New York City history. In 1954, when the owners let everyone know they were going to close the factory and move it to Stanton, Virginia, which is in the Shenandoah Valley, if anyone's ever been there, the workers mounted a week-long factory occupation in order to, one, prevent the factory from moving away, or two, salvage the best severance deal that they could. It didn't work. Okay, so, and then along the way, I'll try and offer just a couple thoughts on manufacturing in New York, the political economy of industrial relocation, and the role of race and gender in fostering the conditions that make a manufacturer stay where it is or go somewhere else. Okay, so the first thing to understand is that New York was in fact a really big and important manufacturing city. People don't always think of it that way, but until the middle of the 20th century, it was not only the country's most important port, but also one of its primary manufacturing sites. In the history of New York City, manufacturing and trade are actually linked quite closely, and they're geographically quite tight. Manufacturing often follows on New York's role as a major port. And so New York City was a great place for exporters. It was also the country's biggest home market, so it's actually a pretty advantageous place to locate your factory. Just to give you a sense of how important manufacturing was in New York City, in the 1940s, over 1 million people in New York worked in manufacturing or one kind or another. Another 400,000 work in the port or in port-related activities. So we're talking around 1.5 million people working in these goods-producing or goods-moving industries. It's a huge part of the political economy of New York. So New York, it's also a center of finance. It's also a center of media. It's also a center of culture. Because it is those things is the reason that New York has survived in a way that other manufacturing cities did not, but at this huge part of the city's political economy really was eliminated during the era of deindustrialization. Now, Brooklyn itself was probably the most intensively industrialized of all the New York City boroughs. So metalworking, so we're talking about the production of razor blades like safety razors, was an especially important industry in Brooklyn, just to give you sense of it. During the 1920s, around 250,000 people in New York were employed by metalworking firms. This is even more than in the garment industry, for which New York is famous, right? So just examples of Brooklyn metalworking firms. A lot of them were located in what we today call Dumbo. So these big factory buildings, you know, like the Verso Loft, have you ever been there? Like that kind of thing. So a factory like E.W. Bliss, they produced basically all the automatic cigarette making equipment in use in the entire United States, right? So this is produced in Brooklyn. Mergenthaler Linotype produces by far the biggest producer of typesetting equipment in the world, you know? And its main competitor, Intertype, was also located in Brooklyn. So it's like, we're talking about metalworking and machine tool industries. Brooklyn, you know, it's a significant part of the political economy of Brooklyn, and Brooklyn machine tools and metalworking is a significant part of the world machine tool industry. American Safety Razor is another example, although of course they're producing a lighter kind of product and it's for consumer use instead of, you know, capital equipment. So at the time of the First World War, just to give you a sense of this, Brooklyn alone ranked fourth in the United States in the total value of its manufactured products. So what I'm trying to say is, like, manufacturing really was a big deal, but you wouldn't necessarily know it if you just landed in New York City today, right? You have to just sort of imagine what it was like. So before unionization, these jobs were awful. To work at American Safety Razor, in 1910, it meant you were working 59 hours a week at 10 cents an hour. In real terms, this is around 5 times less than what the workers were making in the 1940s and 50s after the era of unionization. So attempts to organize were met with violent and well-funded strike-breaking efforts. The strike-breaking in Brooklyn was a really big business. The private investigation agencies that specialize in espionage and violence are a really big business in New York. And then the factory life itself, the factory is like a dictatorship in the way that I think, I mean, we've all had terrible jobs, but the factory was really like a dictatorship in a way I think that it's hard for us to imagine today. The foreman decides who works, when, for how long, and uses their power to extract not just work from you, but really deference and humiliation. And in times of economic downturn, when the labor market competition becomes more severe, this becomes worse. So the foreman extracts not just work from you, but the foreman begins to exercise privileges over you because you're so desperate. It's like, clean my house and you can work. Have sex with me and you can work. I mean, this is what happens during times like the 1930s, before unionization. So how were these plants unionized? The New Deal is an important moment. It establishes the Wagner Act in 1935. So there is now at least moderate government support for unionization efforts and collective bargaining. But in New York City and the plants that we're looking at in Brooklyn, a lot of them really were unionized during the war. And this is when the federal government really begins to step in and enforce the Wagner Act in exchange for labor peace and uninterrupted production. So the American Safety Reserve was organized by the United Electrical Workers, which is the third largest union in the CIO and by far the largest communist-led labor organization in American history. And like Mark was saying, during the Second World War, the politics of the Communist Party were to cooperate in the war effort in the most full, you know, to out-patriot the patriots, right? This is driven by the politics of world communism, overarching commitment to the defense of the Soviet Union, etc. Okay, but what did these unions do in manufacturing plants like this? Well, they raise wages. Like I said, in the 40s and 50s, a worker at American Safety Razor is making around five times in real terms what their counterpart in 1910 made. So this is really a significant rise in wages. They have work rules. They protect workers against speed-ups, which are, you know, de facto wage cuts. They win health insurance, vacation time. They establish seniority systems, which curb this dictatorship of the foreman and also help to curb racial discrimination. Not eliminate, but mitigate. So the UE basically helps desegregate the company cafeteria at American Safety Razor. So if you think segregation was just a Southern thing, it definitely wasn't. And they kind of established what you could really call like a democratic revolution within the plant. Like I said, overthrowing this dictatorship of the foreman and establishing what the CIO unions at this time referred to as industrial democracy, or some measure of democratic decision making in your workplace. Right? This country is supposedly a democracy. You know, you supposedly have a certain amount of freedom and autonomy. That simply did not exist in the workplace until the 1930s and 40s, at least in manufacturing establishments like American Safety Razor. Okay, but from the standpoint of political economy, the main thing these unions did was they build a shelter from competition in the labor market. Now, different unions do this in different ways. Craft unions do it by excluding people from the labor market. Industrial unions do it in a different way, by organizing as many people as possible, right? And winning sort of political control over factories. So that brings me to the two kind of theoretical points I was hoping to make. So one is that manufacturing in the private sector in New York during the era of industrial unionism is part of what I think of as a kind of a brief social democratic settlement that lasts between, let's say, the passage of the Wagner Act or the Second World War and the departure of a lot of these manufacturing establishments in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So this is an attempt to both preserve the scope for profitability, for private profitability, but also create the conditions that the industrial unions are trying to win, to make these jobs, you know, tolerable, reasonably remunerative, give you the rudiments of a dignified life, right? This is a compromise that, frankly, does not last very long in New York City. Because, like I said, these unions, they build a shelter from competition in the labor market, but what they can't build a shelter from and what the city government can't build a shelter from, and even the United States government ultimately doesn't build a shelter from, is capitalist competition outside their jurisdiction. And in the post-war era, this is increasing. It's coming from a whole host of new places. It's coming from the American South, it's coming from the West, and increasingly it's coming from abroad, from Western Europe, from East Asia, so on and so on. And so the runaway plants, industrial relocation, is an important way of collapsing these local social democratic settlements. It's busting that shelter from competition. And the way they do this is by enlarging what Marx called the reserve army of labor, which is a vehicle that acts as a brake on wage growth and therefore labor costs. But the thing is, in order to tap these new reserves, you sometimes have to literally move the factory. Right? If it's not available in the place where you are, you got to move to take advantage. So the question then becomes, like when and under what conditions a company feels itself compelled to tap this reserve army, because there are costs to relocating. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not simple to just pick up 8 floors of equipment, take your whole managerial team and move them to Virginia. They're all from New York. They've never been there before. This is Virginia in 1954. This is the Jim Crow South. Although we will see that was something they kind of liked. But there comes a point where the wage savings that you're going to get from moving will outweigh the costs that you're going to incur from staying. And that's the point when you see a runaway factory happening. The strategy of the union, as you can see, this is one of their leaflets that they produce. They attempted to raise the costs of running away to a point that would make it unfeasible for the company to do it from a cost perspective. This is what the plant occupation is about. This is what their publicity effort to create, you know, an public opprobrium around this company. That's what this is about. So there's kind of an interesting phenomenon around this time. There's the development of kind of infrastructure of runaway plants. So what are we talking about? Factory relocation services, engineering firms that specialize in finding you a new site, telling you how to build a new factory. There are local development corporations that in these places you're running away to that will subsidize. They will get a group of local investors, subsidize your new factory. There are private investigation services that specialize in union, but making sure your new factory is not unionized. And so this is a way of, what this does is it allows firms to kind of share and to spread the cost of relocation, which makes it kind of a class project. So then the question becomes to me, what's happening to these potential labor reserves? What's happening to create these new reserve armies? And in the case of a lot of the southern regions I'm studying, it's the collapse of agriculture. So in the Shenandoah Valley, where American Safety Razor relocates to, it's the collapse of the local apple farming industry.
Where is it relocated? Say again, sorry.
The Shenandoah Valley. So this is like in the shadow of the Blue Ridge Mountains in kind of, let's say, central to southwestern Virginia. So apple farming, right? And the federal government helps with this because during the war, as a result of the extraordinary growth of industrial plant that Mark was talking about, the federal government is paying for the industrialization of a lot of like the Shenandoah Valley, of a lot of other places. So they're building the highways, they're building the plants, right? And so it's like after the war, the apple industry is gone. You have all of this infrastructure and it's like your strategy for survival as a region is, it's kind of obvious. It's the path of least resistance, right? So your goal is to lure these northern corporations south with the promise of workers who are just coming out of an extraordinarily low-paid agricultural sector who are going to work for a lot less than what the people in Brooklyn have fought to work for. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to mention is the role of race in the political economy of wage suppression. So it works differently in the North and the South. So in New York, workers of color are locked into marginal industries. And so American Safety Razor, while it was a big manufacturer, it was also a marginal manufacturer because American Safety Razor is emphatically the number 2 razor blade manufacturer in the United States. It is always chasing its much more technically sophisticated and better resourced competitor, which is Gillette, which is of course still around today. We still use them today, right? We don't use American Safety Razor anymore. So ASR is like the bargain bin razor. And the goal is to beat Gillette on price. And once you have reached the limits of your ability to mechanize, once you've reached the limits of your capital equipment, the only way to compete on price is to hold down wages. And so wage suppression is crucial for American Safety Razor and in New York City more generally, where labor-intensive industries tend to predominate. The garment industry, which is famous, you know, is another example of this. So these industries can stay in New York, I think, as long as they have a big and replenishable reserve army furnished by migration, whether it's the great migration of African Americans from the South, migration from Puerto Rico, which is in full flush during this time, or migrations from other countries, although that's not as big at this time because of the immigration restriction that kind of opens up in 1965. But like what I'm finding in looking at the primary sources in this is that when you look at the lives of these migrants and their children, race hems in their lives in a lot of ways. With residential segregation, police brutality, etc., what you see is a kind of de facto alliance between their low-wage employers, between their landlords who are able to charge extra high rents because of the artificial scarcity created by housing segregation and the police, to lock these workers into a kind of racialized division of labor and to lock workers of color in at the bottom. But there did come a point with the unionization and with the competition from these newly available reserve armies that where the cost savings outrun what is available in New York City. So, but and when you move south, race plays out a little differently. American Safety Razor moved in 1954. This is a big year in Virginia, right? It's Brown versus Board of Education, and Virginia was the state that pioneered the strategy of so-called massive resistance, right? So the last aggressive gasps of Jim Crow are occurring just as American Safety Razor is moving south. And in a place like the Shenandoah Valley, black workers are not locked into the lowest jobs in the plant necessarily as much as they are excluded from the plant altogether, except in the absolute least desirable jobs, like the custodial workers, the lowest paid. So the United Electrical Workers, you know, they have like kind of a theory about Jim Crow, and it is a reserve army theory. So, for example, General Electric, another big company that's moving a lot of its plants south at this time, they had a plant in Louisville, Kentucky. So the workers were paid a lot less than the northern workers. The workers are threatening to go on strike for higher wages. What General Electric does is they threaten to hire African-American workers who make up 15% of the population in Louisville, but 85% of the unemployed, at a rate that's 5 cents below what the workers are making now, right? So this is a kind of really concrete example, and 5 cents was a lot more back then than it is now. So it serves as kind of an insurance policy on militancy. And so what I'm trying to say is that runaway plants in the regime of state-sanctioned violence that we know as Jim Crow were bedfellows. They go together. And
what
the
what'd you say?
Runaways and Jim Crow go together, right? And you see this in the case of American Safety Razor, because when they moved, you had all these kind of puff pieces coming out in the popular media about them, about like, LOL, like Brooklyn people go to Virginia, like they've never been there, like it's funny, it's different, like it's funny. But the American Safety Razor, the owners and the managers are like totally playing along with it, and they're kind of just saying stuff like, man, I really wish the South had won the Civil War, LOL, you know what I mean? Like, we're all Confederates now, I guess, you know, and it's like, you kind of are. So the last thing I'd say is, just to sum it up, the thing that strikes me about, we tend to look back on the era of industrial unionism as like this durable period in U.S. history, but in New York City, at least, industrial unionism in the private manufacturing sector, I mean, we're talking about like in the case of American Safety Razor, 1942 to 1954, so we're talking about 12 years. Even if a plant was organized in the late 30s, you know, if it's gone by the 60s or 70s, we're talking actually about a relatively shorter historical period than I think I was used to thinking about it as. The other interesting thing is that these kind of settlements that the southern plants arrive at in terms of wages, conditions, etc., are often just as short. And in other words, the industrialization of some of these small southern towns is short and fragile. Like, you see this especially in the garment industry. So a lot of these factories move to southern Alabama near the Florida Panhandle. These garment factories only last 15 or 20 years in southern Alabama before they're going to East Asia, or in the case of the ones that I studied, they're going to Haiti. So this is what some economists would refer to as like premature deindustrialization. In other words, the amount of time that a factory or industrialization stays in any one geographical location shortens each time it moves. And so it's questionable whether places that industrialize today receive the same amount of economic development from that. And so then just to put it in the broadest perspective, all of this is ultimately a step in the tendential deindustrialization of the entire United States, which is, I think, part of what Eric was going to talk about.
We'll try to click through. All right, so, yeah, sorry it's late. At the last minute, I changed the title a little bit. So this is about the Volcker Shock, which happened in 1979. I'll explain that in a little bit. And to kind of connect it to the last two presentations, right, this is sort of the outcome of deindustrialization that we've seen in the past 40 years in the United States. And a shift to finance, right, financialization. My project's a little bit more, it's at a macroeconomic level, it's about finance, it's not because I like those things, right, it's because that's what policymakers care about. So how these policies came about, first in the Carter administration, then the Reagan administration. I thought I'd better at the start just explain a little bit about what's going on with financial policy, interest rates, the Federal Reserve, and that sort of thing. So the Volcker shock came about October 79 as a consequence of the rapid inflation that was going on in the 1970s in the United States. And it was a decision that basically tightened interest rates severely. There's a technical way that that happened, but we don't have to get into that unless it comes up. And these high interest rates were basically expected by Volcker, by Carter, by everyone to slow down economic activity. And that was the way to control inflation, right? Which would result in lots of unemployment, but also those who had assets, right, the wealthy, their assets would not lose value because the dollar would remain as valuable as it had been. So interest rates ultimately went up to 20%. This inevitably caused, or above for some people, this caused recession. And that has been blamed quite plausibly for deindustrialization. There was a lot of loss of industrial capacity, which I'll be talking about. And that also greatly weakened unions because there was massive unemployment at that point. So the reserve army was once again expanded more or less across the board. And you know, they were cognizant of this. Another feature of this is that the high interest rates attracted foreign capital inflows. Why does this happen? Well, because if the interest rate's higher, money capital can make more money by being in the US market where interest rates are higher. So foreigners, a lot of this money was coming from the Gulf, from oil states, would put their money in US financial markets to get a higher return on their capital. Money flowing into the US markets also buys up the dollars, creates demand for dollars, so the dollar rises. And that's also good for financial markets because those assets, which are priced in dollars, are now worth more relative to what's going on in the rest of the world. That's a problem for industry, though, because if the dollar is expensive, the goods that are produced by other countries are going to be cheaper relatively to US goods, and that did become a problem in a couple of years. Volcker, it's kind of well understood in political economy that this shift contributed to inequality, contributed in some way to deindustrialization, outsourcing, but exactly what was going on? Some people don't really think that this was entirely intentional, right? They think that the shift to finance was a little bit unexpected. So let me get to that. So what's financialization? Right now, the most cited account is by Greta Krippner, who's got this interesting empirical work on what happened. So her definition is the growing importance of financial activities as a source of profit in the economy. I hope that I can. Does that work? There is a little glare that I noticed from that angle. All right, so it's not employment, right? If I showed employment, finance never takes up anywhere near as much employment as manufacturing, certainly not services. But if you look at this, surprisingly, manufacturing starts out at, you know, 40 or even 50% of the profits in the US economy right back in the 50s, you know, when it was huge. And that declines gradually over the course of time, but it declines a lot in the 70s. And that is, it never really recovers, right? Ultimately, deindustrialization happens after that, but fully. At the same time, finance, you can see, is gaining in its share of profits during the 80s. So that's something we'd like to explain. However, Krippner's argument is that this was not really intentional, that they were not really seeking to improve the fortunes of finance. It just happened that way. Other prominent critiques. Arrighi's got this theorization. He actually introduces the term financialization, really. His picture is that it's kind of inevitable, right? In any system of the world economy, eventually manufacturing is going to tilt over into financialization. So he thinks it's happened again and again. You know, the Dutch financial system, the British shifted from manufacturing to finance, the US shifts from manufacturing to finance. So he's not really surprised that the US eventually gets into a situation where instead of trying to develop manufacturing, the US tries to attract capital from abroad and become a center of financial development. And that's true, but it doesn't seem obvious that it's, you know, inevitable in the way, and it doesn't seem like he's really explained why that had to happen. Another influential account is Robert Brenner, who ends up with an idea of financialization, right? The boom and the bubble that these financial markets expand. But he thinks that comes out of an earlier situation, which he calls the long downturn, right? So from the 60s to the 70s, there was a slowdown of capitalist accumulation, which he thinks was caused by too much competition. Too much capacity for industrial production in different countries created more and more competition, and there was no way out of it for capitalists, for manufacturers, to restore their profitability. But they kept trying, right? So he's got this theory that still in the 1980s, the state was after manufacturing competitiveness. He draws attention to this thing called the Plaza Accord, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But the Plaza Accord was an agreement between the Reagan administration and the other major powers to reduce the value of the dollar. And that did improve the competitiveness of US manufactured goods because they were cheaper to everyone, right? So it seems from this that manufacturing was a big priority, but I'm going to say that's not quite so clear, especially with the Reagan administration. All right. So why did all of this happen? I'm going to argue it was structurally kind of imperative on the US presidential administrations to solve problems for finance because finance controlled the levers of investment. They were determined not to have publicly owned industries, not even to have some kind of industrial policy, but let financial markets decide where to allocate investment. Everything about economic theory to them indicated this would be, you know, a workable way to do it. And that was a big problem in the 1970s because inflation and the falling rate of profit were creating a situation where there wasn't much incentive to do this kind of investment, especially with inflation. You know, those investments would lose value over time unless you continue to raise prices, and then you'd be contributing to inflation. So the priority became, and I think it should be considered a kind of financial crisis, even though it's drawn out, which is to kill inflation by whatever means possible. And Volcker ended up being the one to do it. So you can see on this graph, here's inflation, the blue line, which is climbing up into the late 70s. And these are the interest rates that the Federal Reserve is able to influence, and they just spike in 1979. And that doesn't even do inflation in, right? Inflation continues to happen. So once Reagan is elected in 1981, he encourages Volcker again to spike interest rates. And if you can see these gray vertical bars, those indicate recessions. So there's a recession that's caused in 1980, and that doesn't do it. So there's another bigger recession in 1982, the most severe of the post-war era up to that point. And that finally does bring inflation down, but it also has a lot of other impacts that we'll see. Another thing that's important to consider about this and a little bit more my contribution in this project is that there's also a crisis about the dollar. So while all this inflation is going on, the dollar is also declining in value. Because of inflation, the US had to leave the gold standard in the early 70s, so you see a pretty sharp fall in the value of the dollar relative to other currencies. And then it continues to fall. There's another crisis, really, in 1977, 1978, to the point that other countries start intervening and saying this is not going to work. Germany basically, you know, bends, twists Carter's arm to get him to negotiate, and so the dollar doesn't continue to fall. And capitalists obviously are very concerned about this. It creates a situation where people are thinking either the financial markets are going to kind of leave the dollar. The dollar is not a viable currency for that, and world trade is going to become more diversified in terms of the currencies that it uses, which is obviously concerning for U.S. financial sector, for U.S. capitalists, or it's going to become something that's negotiated with the different countries, which again is something they would like to avoid. So that's the situation of the dollar up to 1980. I feel like I'm going a little long, so I'm going to do this very quickly. But there's an argument out there that supply-side economics doesn't really understand how the economy works. It was more or less an ideology that, and I think there's actually pretty good evidence that it has a one-sided but clear idea about the priority of maximizing the effectiveness of the financial sector. So the idea that the US can become the financial sector of the world, the dollar can remain the most influential, powerful currency in the long run, so long as capital continues to flow into the US. So from very early on, people like Mundell said to get these capital inflows, you have to have high interest rates. that's not going to be so good for manufacturing. Manufacturing depends on borrowing, among other things, to be able to invest. But if financial markets are strong, maybe that's advantageous, at least as this argument goes. And if you don't have a strong dollar, then you lose the dollar status, financial markets go away, you get capital flight, and maybe protectionism, because the economy doesn't see free trade as something that's viable so much anymore. This being the situation, Carter was faced with an intractable problem, and he gave in. Maybe he didn't really have to, but there were very strong structural pressures for him to do so. The financial markets were extremely convinced that something had to be done to crush inflation. And Volcker was there. He was on the New York Fed board, or New York Fed president. He was on the board of the Fed overall. And he was already saying, a stronger and stable dollar is plainly in the interest of the United States. And he was willing to have a recession. He told Carter that before he was appointed. And if you have a recession for Carter in 1980, probably going to lose the election. Carter did it anyway. Bankers were telling him he should do it. This is Stuart Eisenstadt, his policy advisor, said Volcker was selected because he was the candidate of Wall Street, the candidate for the Federal Reserve. And he saw problems for Wall Street. Wall Street continued to get in Carter's policy-making process to influence things right up until the end. So who's the alternative? Reagan, right? Reagan, starting with the supply-side economists, has a pretty consistent overall package that actually is clearly beneficial for finance in various ways. And it understands political economy a little bit more like Marxists might understand it than you would expect. They seem to understand that there's a decline in profitability, that investment is declining, that the way to shift that in capital's favor is to change the terms so that profits are higher, maybe wages are lower. And ways to manipulate this include having high interest rates, right, and then getting a strong dollar and benefiting the financial sector. And the idea is that eventually finance will lead a rejuvenation of U.S. investment. And it's not clear if they really understood whether that would go to manufacturing or not, but it ended up not really going to manufacturing. And this is just a quote from the Treasury Secretary, I'm not going to read it, but explaining pretty much how he thought and the administration thought this was all a coherent system, right? Something they planned out. So capitalists are kind of looking at a choice. With Carter, it's not quite clear if he's strong enough as an opponent of inflation. So most likely, I've listed possible currency policies here, from the weakest to the strongest for the currency. So if you have inflation, you're kind of losing control of the currency. It's ending up in a situation of anarchy. It's going all over the place. That's very bad for financial capital. Reagan says he won't tolerate that at all, but Carter seems to have let it happen some of the time. On the other hand, a strong dollar, where the dollar just rises in value, that was a controversial position, but Reagan basically said, he'd like to have that happen. If they could do that, that would have enormous benefits for the U.S. financial sector, right? Its position in the world economy would be secured in a way that if, there was a more intermediate system with negotiations, it wasn't clear. The Germans, the Japanese, other powers would become involved. The dollar probably would not be able to rise, and it would be a little bit weaker. So given the choice between Carter and Reagan, Reagan obviously offers a stronger solution for capitalists to the economic crisis, and one that probably works out in more unemployment, a bigger recession, this kind of thing. So as 1980 played out, more and more capitalists shifted to Reagan's side. It ended up being pretty overwhelming that was the preferable alternative. Basically from the start, the Reagan administration was enthusiastic about having capital inflows and a strong dollar. These are just two quotes from the Treasury Secretary. The entire economic package should strengthen the position of the dollar at home and abroad. Declining inflationary expectations and rising U.S. productivity should boost confidence in the dollar. It'll attract foreign capital by making the U.S. a better place in which to invest. Stronger dollar and stable prices will also pay substantial dividends in holding down import prices. So they're already looking at the alternative of getting manufactured goods from abroad with this strong dollar. That was part of the plan. Charles Walker is this big lobbyist guy who in private communication says He lays it on the table. There are billions and billions of dollars around the world that will flow into U.S. bonds and stocks, financial markets, just as soon as foreign investors become convinced that the program will work. They'll make plenty of money, and that will sustain Reagan's policy of financial restructuring. So this is actually the same graph as I showed you before, but extended out to 1985. So we cut it off here before, but as soon as this policy comes into effect, the value of the dollar starts rising very sharply. By 1982, it's already recovered everything it lost in the 1970s, and it continues rising from there. By 1982, manufacturers are already complaining, the dollar is too strong, you know, we were competitive when the dollar was a little bit weaker, we're not going to be competitive if it gets much stronger, we're trying to recover here. And the administration ignores that systematically. until they can't. That's a little bit later in the story. But by 1985, it's effectively in a speculative bubble. Even Volcker, everyone in the financial community says there's a possibility we could have a sharp fall in the dollar, so we're willing now to accede to some of the demands of manufacturing. And the dollar does fall, and manufacturing does recover to an extent. So what's happening when manufacturing is weak in this period? Well, you get a mounting trade deficit. So the blue line is basically an attempt to represent capital inflows. And in terms of national income accounts, those balance out the trade deficit. So capital comes into the US to pay for the imports that are coming into the US. And the imports are shown by this red line, which is the trade deficit. So it's clear from the 80s, the history of the 80s, that the US is losing all of this competitiveness in manufacturing, but financial sector is benefiting, relatively speaking, by this infusion of capital. Returns to financial investment improve. The way this graph is set up, if by the way, the black line represents returns to financial investments by households, wealthy people mostly, and in the period of the 70s, they're not really making very much money, or sometimes they're actually losing money on the financial markets. Starting in the 80s and going forward, that problem is solved. You know, the US state consistently tries to make sure that finance and households with financial assets, right, will make money in the markets. On the other hand, manufacturing is declining. So this, I'm starting out with a graph just of machine tools. The Rand Corporation did a big study of it to try to figure out what's going on, partly because if the US doesn't have a machine tool industry, that's what builds machinery for factories. So to rearm, to have a war machine or something, you want to have a machine tool sector. So the Rand Corporation takes an interest there. And this is just one illustration, but as you can see from 1980 to the 1983, US level of production in machine tools just declines drastically. And most of the slack is taken up by Japan and Germany. Later on, it would be taken up by China. So the US is no longer producing what it needs to build new factories, in a way, on a large scale. Highly sophisticated equipment still is produced in the US, but the scale has been lost. So, moving on to other sectors. This is a study by the Institute for International Economics that came out in 1992. They were very concerned that the strong dollar was hurting manufacturing, and they assembled a bunch of evidence basically to show that that was what was going on. And they found capital goods, industrial equipment sectors were losing market share due to the strong dollar, agricultural machinery, machine tools. And how do you explain that? Well, part of it is that the market for US capital goods was light industry. Things like what was produced in New York City. Stuff that didn't require big smokestack industries, steel mills and so forth, would be produced using machine tools. And as the US conceded the markets for light industrial goods, consumer goods, at first it moved to the South, but then very much it moved to other countries where wages were lower and prices would be much lower. That meant these two major pillars of US manufacturing declined quite a bit. And even areas where the US firms were quite competitive started to see a lot of outsourcing during the 1980s. So computers and cars, U.S. firms remained some of the most competitive in the, or the most prominent, at least, in the world, but their actual production increasingly was outsourced, right? Cars to Mexico, computer production eventually to East Asia and others, other places. I'm not going to go through all the remaining sectors. They're a little bit more muddled. Where does the U.S. retain its strong manufacturing advantage? In these high-tech sectors. It still is. Chemicals, aircraft, professional equipment, instruments, that includes medical equipment. U.S. remains very competitive. These are things that are very capital intensive. They don't require that much labor. They don't employ that many people. Labor costs don't affect the price that much. And they're things where the price can be very high because the way they're used in small numbers, but their quality is extremely important. So U.S. manufacturers do very well producing these things. Just doesn't employ very many people. Starting to wrap up here, the arc of it is that more and more U.S. production is either being conceded to foreign producers or is being outsourced, such that by 1984, the U.S. alone is buying up 58% of the manufactured exports from less developed countries. The U.S. is basically integrated into the world market in that way. U.S. manufacturing isn't growing. The government does decide it has to bring down the dollar in the Plaza Accords for the two reasons I mentioned. One, they think it's going to crash because it's unsustainably high. And two, they think it's going to become an obstacle to free trade because manufacturers are unsuccessful in their competition. But then I found this very interesting communication where someone from the administration is meeting with business council economists, often economists from the biggest manufacturers. And what they're saying is they don't really want this protectionism that's being discussed. They don't want tariffs. You know, they don't want the U.S. economy to be the center of their operations. What they want is free trade because they already see so much of their production is happening by their own actions, right, in other countries. They are moving production outside the U.S. They bring it back to the U.S. The U.S. buys it up relatively cheaply, and then they have a big markup. And their profits are there rather than centered in the output of the U.S. industrial economy. So they're not so interested in having a machine tool sector in the U.S. You know, they can get machine tools from Japan, have them be installed in East Asian countries where consumer goods will be produced for the U.S. market. U.S. firms, you know, end up with cheap goods. Wages don't have to rise because there's not so much expense in these consumer goods, and inflation's kept down. It's all very rational for the manufacturers. In other words, this isn't all against manufacturing. It's not all a story of finance getting what it wants and manufacturing being thrown under the rails. What's happening is that the manufacturers are seeing that they have a compatibility with finance, internationalizing the economy, turning away from U.S. labor, which they're finding to be too expensive for their interests, and they're seeing eye to eye, and they're letting the administration do that work for them. I'm not going to read this one either, but basically the story is the Clinton administration adopts this in a much more coherent way. The Clinton administration implements NAFTA, it implements the WTO, it gets free trade that allows an even more extensive shift of anything that's low tech or light industry to other places. I'll just conclude with this. The overall outcome, these are some findings that various scholars have had. Krippner has found that financialization is leading manufacturers more and more into portfolio investment. So after all this has happened, now manufacturers are joining the trend of financialization. But what does that mean? Financialization also leads firms to outsource. Firms that are more subjected to the pressures of finance are outsourcing more to other countries. And you kind of see this outsourcing then coming back to the U.S. in terms of financial sector profits. So the firms start having financial operations as a way of capturing value that's being produced in the rest of the world and in some way incorporating it into the U.S. economy. And then they buy real estate, they buy services, the U.S. financial markets explode, expand, all this kind of stuff. There's this book I find very interesting by John Smith. It's called Imperialism in the 20th Century. And he makes this point that most of the industrial labor right now is being done in countries with much lower wages than the U.S., increasingly so. And those goods then are sold pretty cheaply, and they're purchased relatively cheaply by, you know, the first world. That means that the potential profits of exploiting that labor are not really being captured by firms in China, necessarily. Like, Apple's a great example. Foxconn does the manufacturing in China. It certainly makes profits, right? It exploits workers quite a bit. But Apple then marks up those iPhones and other things by a factor of two. So Apple suddenly captures all of this value added, and it seems like it's a product of the US economy. But actually, it's a product of workers in China, other places, and the US simply is the beneficiary at the end of the day. So I'll just conclude here. What I would add is that this history of strong currency policies by the US optimizes the advantages of outsourcing for US capitalists. It makes the US dollar have high buying power. It means that the US doesn't have, you know, industrial investment that leads to, you know, declining unemployment, inflation, ultimately stronger labor movements, all this kind of stuff, right? The US can keep an austerity economics, keeps the economy pretty cool, and then benefits from cheaply available goods elsewhere. And at the end of the day, the capitalists seek not to invest more in U.S. industrialization, but look to the financial sector, where their returns are not subjected to the risks of market production. It's more like the financial market is something that the government can influence. So as long as financial markets continue to rise, it's a great solution for capitalists, just not for everyone else, right? Okay, so went a little long, but thank you.